Welcome to the first Harper's podcast, produced by 3050's UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and in this first podcast, sponsored by New Zealand Wine Growers, we're looking at New Zealand's regionality, grape varieties, and also sustainable winemaking. G'day, welcome. We've got four distinguished guests from New Zealand today. We've got Nigel Greening from Fountain Road. How are you, Nigel?
I'm filled with joy, thank you.
We've got Tim Finn from Nordoff. How are you, Tim?
I'm just fine, thanks.
John Hancock from Trinity Hill in Hawke's Bay.
I'm filled with water, thank you.
Excellent. And we have Philip Gregan, who is the CEO of New Zealand Wine Growers. How are you, Philip?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. What we're going to be talking about today is we're going to talk a wee bit about regionality, varietals, and also about sustainability. I think we'll just start with the top of the island, John Hancock, and just can you give us a quick overview of Trinity Hills and the region that you're in, and how that's maybe a wee bit different to the rest of New Zealand?
Okay, well, Trinity Hill is a totally Hawke's Bay-based winery, so we don't make wines from outside of Hawke's Bay. The upside from that, from our point of view, is that Hawke's Bay is an extremely versatile region. It's large, some 350 kilometres from one end to the other, some 70 or 80 kilometres wide, so within that there's an enormous range of soil types. We have proximity to the sea. We have altitude. And we have distance south, so we range from very warm areas of Hawke's Bay, such as the Gimlet Gravels, down to southern Hawke's Bay, which is really very cool in comparison. So that allows us to do a very wide range of varieties within the one region, which of course is both a plus and a minus from a regional perspective. That's very difficult to promote diversity as a strategy. So what I believe is really important for Hawke's Bay in the end is to tell the sub-regional story of Hawke's Bay. And I really don't know that there's a more diverse wine region anywhere in the world than Hawke's Bay.
Okay, what are the sub-regions?
Well, you know, we're still really working that out at the moment as part of the Geographical Indications Act, I guess, but some of the better known ones, of course, areas like Timata, the Gimlet Gravels, obviously, Southern Hawke's Bay, Central Hawke's Bay, starting to come into their own, Bayview, which is really at the northern end of pretty much the northern end of grape growing in Hawke's Bay around the Napier region, and down through the Heritonga Plains. There are a very, very large number of names, or geographical names, that are used within Hawke's Bay. And I guess one of the things that hopefully will come out of the Geographical Indications Act is that maybe we can be a little bit tighter on what those sub-regions are.
Okay, and the varieties that you're growing up there?
You're probably talking to the right company, I guess. We probably grow more grape varieties than anyone else in the country, varying from things obviously like Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc. We're now tending to look for the cooler parts of Hawke's Bay for those two varieties, to Pinot Noir in southern and central Hawke's Bay, which does exceptionally well. In fact, in Wine State magazine in Australia just recently, out of 260-odd Pinot Noirs that were in our high country, central Hawke's Bay Pinot Noir, is actually, we did get a little trophy for being in the top five out of that. So people who, you know, when talk Pinot Noir in New Zealand, don't talk Hawke's Bay. Well, I think Hawke's Bay, with certain parts of it, has a real place with Pinot Noir production within New Zealand. And then obviously we go into the more slightly heavier styles of red wines like Tempranillo and Montepulciano being newer varieties. We're also playing around with things like Touriga Nationale, which is interesting. We can certainly do that in Hawke's Bay if you pick the right spots. And then into the more common varieties that we're growing, like Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, etc. And probably the variety that we're getting most recognition for around the world at the moment is Syrah. And as an adjunct to that, we're also using Viognier as a table wine on its own, but also as a co-fermenter with Syrah. So those Rhone varieties seem to do, or Northern Rhone varieties seem to do pretty well also.
And just to give people, because a lot of people have a better understanding maybe of France and the UK, where would you put climatically, where would Hawke's Bay fit?
Well, it's a whole raft of things. That's what I'm sort of suggesting. Central and southern Hawke's Bay, probably Burgundy, or more similar to Burgundy, almost climatically more similar to Burgundy than almost anywhere else in New Zealand. Limestone influenced soils and so on, and I think that the most parts of Hawke's Bay probably very similar, in fact, to Bordeaux, and that we're a maritime temperate climate.
Yep.
And some of the soils, particularly these gravel soils, are quite similar to parts of Bordeaux as well. But I think it's very difficult for people to understand the concept of Hawke's Bay, and that you can make Pinot Noir very successfully. You can also do the other extreme with Cabernet Sauvignon. It's hard for people to come to terms with that, but if you understand the geology and geography of Hawke's Bay, then you'll find that you can actually do those things.
I didn't know about Pinot. I've seen a lot of Pinot used for sparkling wine coming out of Hawke's Bay, right?
Yeah, and that's more out of the sort of more traditional parts of Hawke's Bay, where the people that are doing some quite good things with Pinot Noir, and there are three or four companies in Hawke's Bay doing that, and more into that cooler central, and we're the only ones really in the southern Hawke's Bay so far, but I'm sure you'll see that expanding. And we're continually looking for new vineyard sites in those higher altitude central Hawke's Bay regions.
Okay. We'll move now to Tim Finn from Norda Vineyards. You're in Nelson, probably overshadowed a wee bit by Marlborough, but just over the hills from Marlborough. Do you want to tell us a wee bit about Nelson and how that fits? You're in the top of the South Island.
Yes, we're the top left of the South Island, over the hill from Marlborough. Takes a couple of hours by car, I suppose. Interesting thing about New Zealand and the diversity of regions and the diversities within the regions. You talk about a vintage in New Zealand. Was 05 a small and hot vintage? Well, it was in some place and it wasn't in others, because it's a long, skinny couple of islands. And so any particular vintage that you talk about, you've got to say which bit of New Zealand are you referring to, which side of the country. Interestingly, Nelson, which is in the middle of the top of the South Island, and we were protected on three sides by hills and mountain ranges that keeps the rain away, as it were, and open to the north to the Tasman Sea. Probably on a vintage variation basis, we are closest to Central Otago, because they're in the middle down the bottom. So depending on whether New Zealand's weather is coming from the west or coming up the east coast, we have that sort of vintage. Whereas compared to Marlborough, which is only 2 hours away, we will often have quite a different vintage to them for the same reasons. In the same year. But over a number of years, we cross the same sort of regimes of temperature and rainfall and what have you.
Because I always thought Nelson's been quite hot, you know, almost people talk about Hawke's Bay or Nelson having the most sunshine hours in New Zealand.
Yes, Nelson generally has the most sunshine hours. Every now and then we we bow in the direction of Marlborough or something.
Or Whakatāne.
But I think, let's say, 9 out of the last 10 years have been Nelson. But you're right. A lot of sunshine hours, but not necessarily hot. We're a very warm place. Long, warm summers, and in fact, quite cool nights certainly heading towards vintage. And you see that reflected in the wines. They have that generally lovely mineral acidity that carries the fruit characters through. And so you have those lifted styles that we produce so well there. Nelson itself, the sort of the major diversity within Nelson itself is the fact that we have the young gravelly soils between the rivers on the plains, similar to Marlborough, I guess. And we have two lots of plains doing that, Motueka and the Nelson Plains. And then in the middle, we have the Mutri Hills, which are ancient hills, clay soils that have brought down a lot of old river shingle with them, quite deep. So they end up being a sloping, draining clay, which is quite marvellous for some styles of wines.
And slightly heavier Chardonnays? Or?
Absolutely. It gives you more texture and density, I guess, in the wines. Have to be, as it were, farmed in a different way. They have different structural characteristics. Don't need any irrigation because of those clays there. But they're not boggy like clays can be. So, for instance, the Mutri Hills in Nelson really love Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. They do that particularly well and give a minerality and a density to those wines. Down on the plains, you'll get more and perhaps more typical New Zealand fruit characters. That's where we grow our Sauvignon Blanc down there. It's marvellous for Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Gris, Riesling, aromatics generally, but also another style of Pinot Noir down there. Temperature range-wise, Pinot Noir is about the only red wine that we can constantly ripen, and we ripen it very well. We're right in the middle of that range with Pinot Noir. It suits us, but when you start stepping out into Shiraz or Cabernet Sauvignon, you're just getting, the numbers game gets too hard, really. Yeah. One vintage and five, you might just about get there. So if you talked before about the dreadful comparisons with the Northern Hemisphere, interestingly, the wines from the Moutry Hills often tend to be seen as more European in style. We can always see them as New Zealand, but I think the clay soils do tend to give us that less fruit-forward style to perhaps a more European look at the particular varieties. And if we were going to place ourselves, we'd be somewhere near Chablis, I think.
Oh, really? That cool?
Yes.
All right, and the last person we have is Nigel Greening from Fountain Road, which is a fairly iconic wine in England, particularly Pinots. Do you want to tell us a wee bit about Otago?
Yeah, the world's most dangerous wine-growing region. world's most southerly wine-growing region, and, yeah, home of kind of bungee jumping and orcs and that kind of thing. But as a region, it is a region of extremes. Compared to anywhere else in New Zealand, massive diurnal shifts, which means essentially cold nights even when you have hot days. Central Otago, although it's right down south, which means it's at the cold end of New Zealand and can have extremes of cold happening at any time of year, we've seen snow from 2003 to 2006. Every year we had snowfall in February, that snowfall in August in UK terms. So an indication of just how wild it can get. But we're, ironically, because we have the only region that has a continental climate, we're isolated by mountains from the coast, we get some very high temperatures during the day. So we can be New Zealand's hottest place during the day and its coldest place the same night. We've seen days when it's been 33 during the day and 3 at night, so 30 degrees of diurnal shift, and that's really Central Otago's secret weapon.
What does it do to the wines?
It preserves acidity and it preserves aromatics, essentially. It allows the wine to keep a vividness about it, or we believe that's what causes it, something causes it, and that seems likely. I think one important thing to cover, if you try and make climatic comparisons to Europe, they don't work because we have a range of different influences. If you looked simply at weather data, Central Otago by comparison to Burgundy, you shouldn't be able to ripen Pinot Noir. It should not be possible. But Burgundy doesn't have our UV levels, and New Zealand is strongly UV-driven. We have a much higher percentage of UV and sunlight throughout the country, but especially in the south. So for a relative temperature range, we can get greater ripeness in fruit, essentially in a climate where we shouldn't be able to ripen grapes like Pinot Noir. We can ripen them, and even ripen them in a cool season, because even when it's cool, we still get the UV.
I'll come on to the UV in a wee bit, because it's quite an interesting point of difference with New Zealand.
It's another reason it's a dangerous wine-growing region, by the way.
Certainly.
We have to put 30-plus sunblock on our vines.
And Philip, just Philip Regan, from the CEO of New Zealand Wine Growers, do you want to just give us a big overview of, you know, we've had a bit of detail about the different regions. Do you want to give us an overview, maybe, of the other regions that weren't covered, but also how you see the regional diversity within New Zealand?
Thanks. I think if from the descriptions we've heard so far, the thing that stands out about New Zealand is you have a very young land, where in fact the land is still being formed. And that has a lot of mountain ranges which separate river valleys. And most of the wine regions where grapes are planted are in those river valleys separated by the mountains. And that means that regionality is something that sits fairly naturally on the shoulders of the New Zealand wine industry. The regions are distinctly different. You know, for example, Marlborough, as Tim Finn has said, is only 2 hours away by car over a good-sized hill from Nelson, but it's quite a different region. It's got a different feel about it if you go there, and the wines are quite different. Similarly, Hawke's Bay is about a 2.5-hour car journey from Gisborne, and again, there's a completely different feel about the place because it's different river valley separated by mountains from Hawke's Bay. The one sort of exception to the rule about the mountains and the valleys is the Auckland region, which is quite diverse. We have grapes on Waiheke Island out in West Auckland and South Auckland. It's only a small region, and the concentration there tends to be on Chardonnay or Cabernet and Merlot, those sorts of grape varieties. But that's the one exception to the river flats, mountains ruled in terms of regionality. The other significant area in the country, of course, is Waipara / Canterbury.
That's quite a new region coming through, though, into the UK.
Yes, it's a region which originally was based around vines planted around Christchurch, which is the largest city in the South Island, but it's tended to migrate about 70 kilometres north to the Waipara area, which is sheltered from the sea influence by some hills, which makes it slightly warmer. But again, it's consistent with the rule about mountains and valleys because it's about a three-hour drive from Marlborough with significant mountain ranges between Waipara and Marlborough. And it's just a continuation of that theme of distinct regions which give it personality and individuality to the wines, which ultimately represents a great opportunity to add a lot of depth and texture to the New Zealand wine story.
Do you think soils play a big part in New Zealand? In Europe, for example, some sort of soils are quite important because they are reasonably free draining. In New Zealand, you can irrigate, so it's not so much of an issue.
I think it's profound. It's always profound with wine, by definition. We have very, very different soils from one part to another. And in general, we started off as a country tending to grow grape varieties that like very free-draining soils. And so the gravels of Marlborough, classically, were where a lot of New Zealand's reputation was made. But the heavier soils that create denser wines with varieties like Chardonnay and Pinot, that we see in central Otago, you see in Nelson, and they make distinctly different wines. Central Otago is a very geographically complex area because you get a lot of river basins where you've got gravelly soils where there's stuff planted, but then there's also a lot of glacial soils and windblown lerths, which is very, very fine and dense. And the difference in personality of the wines is certainly striking there, just as it is between Mutari, where you get that denser wine coming from the clay and then the brighter wines that come from the gravels.
A lot of New Zealand wines do appear to be coming from the river valleys, though, as opposed to moving up the valley walls. Is that still the case, or are we starting to see...
I think one of the things that's different, obviously, about New Zealand than Europe, and Philip touched on it before, is that the soils are still forming. So whereas in Europe, they tend to plant on the hillsides because they're less fertile, and because the river valleys have had all the soils washed off the hills into the valleys. That in a lot of parts of New Zealand that hasn't happened yet. So the soils have still got the hillsides have still got the soil, topsoil on them, whereas the valleys tend to be less fertile in some cases, and certainly the case in the Gimlet Gravels, whereby the hillsides with the soils on them really show a little bit too much fertility to be planting on the hillsides. So the reasons for planting on hillsides in Europe are quite different for the reasons that you would plant on hillsides in New Zealand.
And partly also aspect to get more sunlight, but that's not really an issue for you guys?
Often it's the other way around and we're looking for shade. Or it is for us in Central.
Nigel, you mentioned the UV ozone hole, or not so much the hole, but there is a hole.
We can talk about the hole.
But it has been closing up. Some people say that things like the polyphenols or the aromatics that are coming out of New Zealand is partly to do because of the UV light that's coming into New Zealand. And are you worried that if this hole does close up over time, you might lose your edge?
No, I don't think we are. We're getting into complex territory here, and I don't want to get too technical, but the ozone hole itself tends to be affecting the higher end of the frequency range of UV. And in general, we get a broad spectrum high UV spreading regardless of whether the hole is there or not. And we don't see a difference when the hole closes or opens. We get high UV regardless.
I think it's to do with the angle. the angle of the sun, the way the angle that the sun hits through the atmosphere in the lower part of the hemisphere is as much as the ozone layer.
Okay.
Yeah, I think a thing you've got to think about too is that in the southern hemisphere summer, the Earth is closer to the sun than during the northern hemisphere summer, and the solar flux naturally is 7% higher. Combine that with the very clear air, because we're out in the middle of the ocean, we don't have the particulate matter in the air, and what you get is a high level of solar important to the grapevines. And that's not going to be influenced by any hole in the atmosphere at all. They're there, and they're things that have been there for a long time, and it's just the fact of New Zealand.
Okay. An interesting side issue of that is we have been doing some research work on increasing UV on the grapes. And in fact, we've been using mussel shells under the vines in this particular bit of research. And that gives us UV bounce back onto the grapes, Pinot Noir especially, with the aim of allowing the phenolics to have an earlier ripening period. And get it ahead of the sugar ripening.
So you get your alcohol a bit lower.
Absolutely, and that was the aim of the experiment. And the reality is that the grapes that have had this higher UV from the light bounced off the mussel shells does have riper flavours than the control. And so it's not like we're over the top with our UV at this stage. A bit more UV, in fact, in this situation has been helping the ripeness.
Okay, that's actually something quite interesting, is that you're still experimenting quite a lot in New Zealand.
You know, absolutely. I think John talked before about the country was still forming. Well, the winemakers are still forming too, and we're very early adapters, and we're very quick to try something new or to try a new place. As soon as we think this is a good area to be growing grapes, you blink and everyone's growing grapes there. But similarly in what we do in the vineyards, their viticultural methods, what we do in the wineries, we're very quick to try new things. It seems obvious, obviously, that we don't know it all yet.
No.
But we're very happy to learn as fast as we can.
I think there's an important point that we're allowed to try things. Yeah. A big benefit we have, when I talk to my friends in Burgundy, Jean-Nicolas Mayer, I remember once said to Decanter when they asked what's his perfect vineyard, thinking, you know, as a man who's got big hunks of things like Richebourg and Romilly Saint-Vivant, he'd talk about those. And he said, I'd like my own Pinot vineyard in central Otago where I could make proper Pinot Noir without being told how to do it. And we have this ability to experiment and try things. And I know the experiments with mussel shells, and I mean, Neil started it with plastic mulches, and Steve's been doing tests like this in Martinborough with mussel shells, I know. And it's great to be able to try these things and see what they do. It's also important that you don't go off at a tangent. It takes a long time to learn stuff. You learn it over generations. You don't learn it in a couple of years. And so it's a long, slow game as well.
We've got a slow deal.
Yeah, I think that comment there also is that we certainly don't know what all the answers are, but I'm sure in some cases we don't even know what the questions are that we should be seeking the answers to at the moment. You know, we are very young.
You were talking about the new geographical indicators coming in. Do you think it's early, too early to maybe look at geographical indicators for New Zealand? And one of the things with, say, AOC, Wines in France, is they do get limited quite a lot. Are your geographical indicators going to control how you ferment, for example?
No.
No. I think there's a big difference between geographical indicators.
Guarantee of origin as opposed to
appellations. Appellations are about production controls as well as the geographical indicators. We're talking solely about geographical indicators here. We're not talking about limitations on what you may plant, what your yield may be, how you make the wine, limits on irrigation. None of that. I don't believe that will ever apply in New Zealand, because we have to be in the position to continue to learn, and you only learn by experimentation and innovation in a new industry.
And it's not too early for geographic indicators. We may discover greater subtleties as things go on, but we've already got our handle on the big issues. We know where things are growing and showing a distinctive difference because of their place, and that's the important thing.
From a marketing point of view now, moving into that side of things, New Zealand seems to to me, to have reasonable awareness of the main geographical regions in New Zealand. Marlborough, most people have heard of Hawke's Bay, and Otago's coming up. I'm a bit biased, I'm an Otago boy, so I will say that. But even, you know, in the more elite in the wine world in the UK, Otago's getting well known anyway. How do you think geographical indicators will help that? And also maybe talk about where you think varietals in terms of exports are going to be going in the next couple of years. Maybe what's being put in the ground at the moment or what has been put in the ground that's about to come through. I'll start with Philip because I think you have a good overview.
Yeah, I think as we've described, there's a natural separation of regions in New Zealand, and we are strung out as a country in a north-south gradient. There is, in most regions, a focus on a particular selection of grape varieties. So from, you know, essentially from north to south, you are going from the warmer grape varieties to cooler. So in regions such as Auckland and Hawke's Bay, you have a focus on reds such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Syrah. In the southern regions, the red variety that ripen is Pinot Noir. White varieties, there's a focus on Chardonnay in Gisborne and Hawke's Bay. The further south you go, that focus on Chardonnay tends to lessen. There tends to be a greater focus on Sauvignon Blanc in the middle regions of Marlborough, Nelson and Martinborough. And then also you start to see the emergence of Riesling and Pinot Gris, as well. So there's a natural sort of focus in each of our regions on a particular suite of grape varieties. As John has said, however, in Hawke's Bay, given the range of climates and soils that are in that region, you probably see greater diversity, a sort of a fruit salad, if you would like. And as John says, that represents a challenge for Hawke's Bay.
How are you guys marketing your wines in the UK, though, and around the world? Because everybody's heard of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, but they don't necessarily hear of Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, or they might have starting to get their head around New Zealand Pinot, but is geographical indicators a really key part of your marketing strategy, or is it something you're developing?
It depends on the market. I think that if you go to the United States, they know New Zealand. They don't know anywhere else. If you go to Australia, they have much greater level of awareness of the regions. And in the UK, as we've talked about, they know Marlborough, the Hood of Hawke's Bay, Nelson, maybe, Central Otago starting to emerge. So the regionality and sub-regionality represents an opportunity for us to broaden the New Zealand story and add a lot more depth and texture. And as I said before, I think it's something that sits very naturally in New Zealand, given our geography, and that represent, we're not forcing an issue here about regionality. It's natural for us to do it, given the nature of the country, and that represents a great opportunity to add texture and excitement about the New Zealand wine story. Obviously, it's going to depend on where we're at in each country, but in the UK, for example, there's a great opportunity to talk about regionality. From a Marlborough context, a great opportunity to talk about sub-regionality in terms of Sauvignon Blancs.
I think you can't separate, especially in the UK, but in a lot of markets, increasingly in America, you can't separate New Zealand wine from New Zealand tourism. It's fundamental. We have so many people now holidaying in New Zealand from the UK, and people go, and once they've been, they become ambassadors. They become almost obsessed with this wonderful experience they had, and they tie that to the wine. And when we are talking to customers at wine shops or at tastings like the one we're doing tonight, a very high percentage of those people will have travelled to New Zealand, and once they've gone, they become ambassadors for life. So a lot of that communication, I think, is closely tied up to this warm feeling people have for the country. We're quite good at not going out and having wars and shooting people and making enemies, and so it does seem to work very well in that respect. And I think that's one reason why regionality works very naturally for New Zealand, because a lot of people who buy the wines have been there, they've been round, they know what Central Otago is, or Marlborough is, or Hawke's Bay is, because they've been there on holiday.
I think the other thing that we need to bear in mind too is that New Zealand's some 1,500 to 1,600 kilometres long, And if you actually put that into a European perspective, it runs from somewhere like Champagne to Madrid. Yeah. And of course you're going to get an enormous amount of variation of climatic conditions so on within that region. New Zealand's not just this little island or two islands stuck off the coast of Australia somewhere. It's actually, in terms of length, it's quite substantial. You know, you do have to bear in mind the fact that it's going to be influenced quite dramatically by both the Pacific Ocean and the Tasman Sea. But in terms of latitude, it's actually fairly substantial.
Tim from Nordhoff and Nelson, how do you feel about regionality, given that your region is, you know, on the side of what is one of the big regions of New Zealand? You know, do you feel that Nelson gets a fair chance to express itself?
Well, we're enjoying more life in the sun as time goes by. I think it's as we have been talking, as the markets mature and they get to know us, they start to see more diversity and seek more diversity. And interestingly, some of the reports that we get back from the British trade now are showing that they want more diversity in the Sauvignon Blanc. They don't want any one particular style. And so you can get that diversity within Marlborough, but you can also get that diversity by looking at other regions of Sauvignon Blanc. And we tend to be in those niche markets to some extent. Our Sauvignon Blancs are very strongly Nelson in their characteristics, and we as a winery tend to aim more for things like structure and texture and that as well. And so you know, we always used to glibly say, how many Marlborough Sauvignon Blancs do you want on your wine list? A bit disparagingly, I suppose, from Nelson. But the reality is people are saying that they do want a range of flavours and a range of characteristics. Yes, you're quite right. Nelson is... it's very hard to promote in a soundbite what Nelson is about, because we do a lot of varieties very well. And so you can't really say, Nelson... home of Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Gris, what do you want? We do it. Okay. And so it's not quite so easy to put it there in someone's mind.
I'm going to just go around the table again and ask each of you guys what grape variety that you think is relatively new or that you're planning on working on maybe as part of your experimentation, if you are looking at that. We'll start with John Hancock. You mentioned some interesting non-French varieties.
We are doing some of the Spanish varieties and I guess also, well, Iberian varieties, I suppose, both Spanish and Portuguese, which we think have the opportunity to produce some quite different wine styles to what we're already doing within Hawke's Bay. So it gives us something quite special that we are able to show people that we can do. White variety-wise, you know, we're playing with things like Viognier with a lot of success. Seems to work very well in our region. The natural extension of that, I guess, is some of the other own white varieties like Roussanne and Marsanne.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc, I think it's nice to have a few more strings to your bow.
Yep. I was talking to Simon Wakeman, who was earlier, he's a winemaker in Marlborough, and he's going to be planting up some Albarino, which is a nice Galician.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people are looking at alternatives like Albarino and Grüner Veltliner and so on. I don't like necessarily doing things just for the sake of doing them. There's got to be some purpose behind it, but I think diversity of varietals is a good idea. New Zealand, over a long period of time, has been restricted to such a small number of varieties that to have some alternatives that we can do things with, I think, is really important.
Gives you a chance. Tim, what are you guys experimenting with?
I think, first up, you've got to step back and say, experimenting with new varieties, we're still experimenting with Chardonnay and and Pinot Noir. How long it takes, as I think someone mentioned before, a generation or so to be coming to grips with their own soil types and their own varieties that are on it. I know the media particularly likes to say, hey, what's new? What's new, in fact, is the 2007 vintage, which is really good, and we've done some really good things compared to last year. And we are trying new things. So there's that aspect. But that's not to say we don't look at other varieties as well. And you mentioned Albarino. Obviously, it's one that suits Nelson. Nelson, I think, is the biggest seaport in the Southern Hemisphere. And it's one of those varieties that goes particularly well with shellfish, and it goes, by all accounts, particularly well in the sort of climate range that we have in Nelson. So it would seem to be a nice fit. People are looking very strongly at that now. I've got to say, we've only had Pinot Gris in the ground for 10 years, and we're certainly experimenting with that, because that's, you know, that's no time at all in terms of finding the styles and deciding what you are going to do to make the world's best Pinot Gris in years to come. And I'm not going to do that in the next couple of years. It's going to take a number of years to make those decisions and follow them through and see the results in bottle for a while. So winemaking, it's an artisanal endeavour. You're in there, you're doing it, and you're seeing the results, and you're working your way through the generation.
And Nigel? From
I think the most exciting emerging wine variety in New Zealand is Syrah by a long way. I'm not going to plant any. I don't have the climate for it. But New Zealand's proved it can make great Pinot Noir, and it's now showing the world that it can really make world-class Syrahs. And so I think if you're pointing at one thing that's really exciting, it would have to be Syrah. I really agree with Tim that, you know, we focus all our efforts on learning what we're doing already. One of the things that the three of us have in common is a passion for Chardonnay. And although we grow distinctly different styles because of our climatic and our soil differences, we all love making Chardonnay. It's the hardest grape for us all, I'm sure. I know it is for us. It's the one that you really have to think hard about if you're going to make your point with it, because it is such a manipulative grape. It's not one like Pinot. Pinot is not a winemaker's grape. It's one where you need a winemaker with the respect to stand away from it, let it grow up to be the child it wants to be. Chardonnay is the child that you can impose some of your style and personality on. And so it's a great fun variety. And I know it's one that all of us feel is the most underplayed, in my opinion, of all the New Zealand varietals. We can make fantastic Chardonnay, and I'd love to see people pay more attention to that.
And we'll finish up with Philip. Varietals that you haven't been mentioned?
Well, I've got to put a plug in for one of my personal favourites, which is Gewürztraminer. I think there's some really exciting stuff happening with Gewürztraminer. It's a great variety that's perhaps saddled with a name which many people find difficult to say, but I think a well-made Gewürztraminer is a great wine, and I think we're starting to see the emergence of one or two very, very, very exciting Gewürzes in New Zealand, which, given that I love it, I personally is very pleasing.
With the dawn of Asian cuisine in the UK, it's doing quite well.
We couldn't let the day go, though, without really focusing on Riesling. Because it's one of the great grapes of the world. New Zealand can do it spectacularly well. Once again, it hasn't had the push, and it hasn't had the market out there, but that's certainly growing. And there are Riesling geeks all over New Zealand, hidden away in winery cellars.
Mainly winemakers.
Mainly winemakers. But, you know, you're going to see fantastic Rieslings coming out from New Zealand over the years.
That's brilliant, because Riesling's been getting quite a big push all around the world at the moment.
Yeah, for the last 30 years.
The Renaissance still coming.
But German wines are starting to be able to sell all their wines now, that's Riesling. Mm. So, you know, that's a pretty good going.
Oh, the good guys are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just so interesting, I noticed you didn't mention Pinot Gris. That's an aromatic that...
Well, yeah, Tim gave it a little bit of a
plug. I gave it a plug.
I've heard of it.
Pinot Gris is to some extent seen as the lunching ladies' wine, I think, and it goes so well with everything. People like to say the name of the restaurant, even Pinot Grigio is a good one to roll off the tongue. But I think New Zealand can do particularly well with Pinot Gris, partly because we do retain that marvellous acidity, which can lift Pinot Gris from being a somewhat flabby, amorphous white wine to actually having some character. And I think New Zealand Pinot Gris may well, in the end, be specific as New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
I've heard Pinot Gris described as wine for people that don't like wine. Now, I'm not knocking it, but the reason people say that is it's very easy to make bland Pinot Gris. And the reason there's always a bit of a pause with winemakers when you talk about it is there's still a debate as to what Pinot Gris in New Zealand is going to become. And that's an ongoing project. And I think it'll take another decade or more before we've really got a handle as a nation as to what we're trying to do with Pinot Gris. And then perhaps we'll see it really move forward. I personally love what Martinborough can do with Pinot Gris, where you get these very substantial, much more in the Alsace style, rich, oily, succulent Pinot Gris. So, yeah, it can be done, but it's the wine that's most a work in progress of anything in New Zealand, I'd say.
The other big topic that's sort of coming up these days is sustainability. There's been talk in the press in the UK about CO2 emissions. We'll ask Philip just to give us an overview of what New Zealand sustainability is all about.
We launched a policy in the middle of the year which basically said we want to see every winemaker and grape grower in New Zealand participating in a sustainability scheme by year 2010. And one of the key criteria for that is that the scheme have the aim of producing sustainable grapes and wine, but also that the schemes be independently audited. From our perspective, we don't care whether it's organics, biodynamics, our own scheme, Sustainable Wine Growing New Zealand, or anything else. We believe that it is something that grape growers and winemakers need to do, for the simple reason that, three simple reasons: it's the right thing, it's what the market expects, and hopefully it's going to produce better wines as well. We don't want it to be a sort of a headline. We just want it to be something that we do. It's an intrinsic part of the process of grape growing and winemaking. The feedback we get from most grape growers and winemakers in New Zealand simply is it's the right space and it's the right thing to do. We've been very pleased with the feedback we've had from the industry about that policy, and I think it's going to be a platform for a lot of people to say, we just won't go with the sort of the minimum industry standards, as it were. We'll look to organics or biodynamics or whatever, and we think that's a great thing if that's the path that that people choose to go down. I think it's a good opportunity for us, but it's just got to be something that people do as a natural part of their grape growing and winemaking. It can't be something that's forced. You've got to do it, and you've got to be able to demonstrate that you do it.
What's the difference between, say, biodynamics, organics? Sustainable viticulture, biodynamics, organics, people know what they're talking about. Well, some people know what they are, but sustainable viticulture is something fairly new.
Okay, I want to raise a point here, see if everybody agrees around the table, because this
probably
takes
not
us into different... I think actually people might. It takes us into different territory, because when we start using words like sustainability, generally, in the past, the focus hasn't truly been on sustainability. It's been much more on simply issues of reducing pesticides, herbicides, on kinder, shall we say, farming. There are much bigger issues in sustainability these days. Issues such as the amount of CO2 it takes to make a glass bottle and the weight of your glass bottles. Issues such which are much larger and relate to the overall impact and energy impact that a winery has within its greater environment, the effect that it has on environments that are divorced from it through the things like the electricity it consumes, which may be generated 500 kilometres away. So these are big, complex issues. They're no longer just about what do you put in your vineyard. They're about how do you run your company so every aspect of it is really sustainable. And we've been, I think, as a winemaking industry, really pushing wine growers to move forward and look at these things. And things like carbon auditing standards are being looked at very hard. We're looking to the New Zealand government to introduce official audited systems to enable us to put our hand up and really talk about these issues from a point of confidence where people understand what we're talking about. You can't at the moment even get into conversations about how much carbon you use because there is no internationally agreed term of carbon ethics to say who owns what carbon. If I'm counting up the carbon to make wine, do I count the carbon taken to manufacture my tractor in Germany? Or does that belong to the German tractor manufacturer? No one's dealt with these issues. So we need international standards. Then we can move forward to say how truly sustainable we are. And then we can take actions to make sure we become more sustainable.
To me, buying carbon credits from someone in Brazil or whatever to rectify problems
insanity.
In your own is just bloody madness. Yeah.
It's like abusing your children and then giving money to the NSPCC to make up for it. Yeah. It is completely insane. Carbon credits are not the answer. Using less energy is the answer.
What about in New Zealand, though? Because a lot of the energy is, particularly in the South Island, is all hydro dams. So it has fairly minimal carbon influence.
We're one of the cleanest places on Earth to make wine, whether you're North Island or South Island. Our carbon profile's extraordinarily low. And actually, because there's very little disease pressure through most of New Zealand, compared to a lot of wine growing around the world, we have to use very little in vineyards. And so we start with a head start. It would be great to keep that going. But if we're going to really make that work, there are some tough issues we have to address. We can ship wine very efficiently. Shipping wine is not an issue because container vessels are so efficient. Flying's an issue. We've already started to audit and figure out what we're doing to reduce our flying, because when you live in New Zealand or spend a lot of your time around the world, you spend a lot of time on planes. So they're real issues for us. And they may end up being more important than whether you're putting herbicide in your vineyard.
True. It is really interesting, though, if you think about it, New Zealand being the small country having so little impact on the world ecology compared with the sort of industrial powerhouses of Eastern Europe and China and so on. But, you know, we live in such a fragile ecology that would be absolutely stupid not to really practice responsible agriculture, and taking consideration all the other aspects that you were talking about as well, Nigel. But, you know, to me, it's a matter of respecting the overall environment that we're actually in. You know, let's face it, if New Zealand was densely populated, then we'd have the same issues with pollution and so on that anywhere else in the world has.
And I think the comment to make is whatever system people are involved in, what they're all trying to do is to get the grape grower or the winemaker to really think about what they're doing before they do it. And that's certainly what we're encouraging the industry is. It's not to apply a system to say, here's all the answer. Rather, it's to say, in my particular vineyard, what are the systems that are going to work for me? How do I manage, minimise my impact on the environment, not just the way I grow grapes, but the way I go about marketing and how I package them. So it's really getting people to think before they act, and that's really, really important. And it's not here's the answer, it's about thinking and then an application in each individual circumstance, because every grape grower, every winemaker, ultimately at the end of the day, is going to be different.
Philip, I totally agree with you there, and I think the good thing is that we are talking about it and we are thinking about it, because it wasn't very long ago when no one was, and if anyone did, they got poo-pooed. Now it's a legitimate topic of conversation at morning tea or at any other time. And when I think of sustainability, it used to be just a buzzword. Now I actually think of, if I'm leaving my vineyard and winery to my daughter and her kids or whatever, what's it going to be like? Is the land going to be better than it was when I first took it over from the German immigrants who farmed it at Neudorf? Those sort of factors suddenly become centre of mind, and you think, well, should I be tramping over this ground and wet weather with my heavy tractor all the time and ruining the structure or whatever, those sorts of things. And certainly in the pesticide side of things, in terms of what is likely to be residual and what is likely not to be residual, you suddenly start to see it in a real context.
You mentioned that you wanted everybody, well, there was a target of 100% sustainable. Is that going to be legislated, or you said you also had good uptake from people. How are you going to ensure that occurs? And are there real sticks in the mud?
You know, if it's to be, it's up to me, I think is really the whole philosophy. You can't force people to do that sort of stuff. What you can do is teach people how, or give people the mechanisms so that they can think about those things. rather than legislate to do it. It's almost impossible.
Yeah, in our view, is we said that's the goal we'd like to achieve. Ultimately, it's up to individual grape growers and winemakers as to whether they participate or not. And that's the way it should be, because, you know, the freedom to act in your own way is, I think, and to experiment and to do things is very important in terms of individuality. But the feedback, as I said before, the feedback we've got from most of the industry, it's the right thing to do. And the second part is, give us the tools to help us actually go down that path and point us in the right direction.
Sustainable viticulture, that is quite different, though, to, say, the organics. Can you just... I just really want to tease out what it is, because I find it quite hard to understand. I've spoken to quite a few people about it, and I get a slightly different picture from everybody.
Can I first, on the same line, just put in one aspect of that? People like to talk in sound bites, and they like to talk in these labels. Now, the reality is everyone is on some sort of line of what they are doing in their vineyard, and they do some things and not others. Now, some particular groupings earn a badge and they call it this, and some people are doing other things. We've been making compost for a number of years, and we put it in. We're not biodynamic or organic, but we do what we think is right for our situation. We do other things to minimise use of the tractor on the land, which may include doing a weed spray strip under the vines, because I think it's better for my soil to be, you know, having one pass with a weed sprayer versus a number of passes with something to cut the grass down underneath the vines. But we also have a row down the centre of each row that's permanent sward, so we have organic matter going back in that way. So we make up our own grouping of things that we do that we think, in the true meaning of the word, sustainable, and that things are going to be better when I leave them, perhaps than when I first came across them. We are building up organic matter in the soil. But we're not seen as organic because we don't do the whole range of organic. We're certainly not seen as biodynamic because there's another whole range of things there. So it's I guess I get a wee bit offside with pointing at various groups and saying, you're good, you're bad. You know, if you're not one of these groups, you've got to be out there somewhere raping the planet.
Yeah, I think organics, biodynamics, sustainable wine growing, what they all are is management systems for a vineyard, winery, according to a particular set of criteria. Now, the criteria between the different systems vary. That's why they are different systems. And, you know, you can get into an argument about whether one system's better or not, better than the other, and frankly I think that's completely non-productive. The point is that everybody is trying, through the system that they adopt, to move forward on the path towards sustainability. And what constitutes sustainability is going to change through time as new information becomes available. 20 years ago, nobody cared about the carbon footprint. Today everybody does, so you've got to incorporate carbon footprint. In 10 years' time, water may be the major issue, whereas 10 years ago, who cared about water? So I think the definition's going to change through time, and it's got to be fluid, and it's got to be both proactive and reactive to the issues that are current.
And it doesn't want to be driven as a marketing tool, in my mind. And unfortunately, look what's happened in the UK with the supermarkets. It's exactly driven by marketing. It's nothing else. Like it was 10 years ago with ISO or whatever. Nobody even cares about ISO anymore. It's just stupid.
Well, we've had big issues here with air freight, with fresh vegetables. And, yeah, you've got to consider this. But actually, when you do the maths, you find that an agricultural worker in Kenya only uses a 20th of the carbon a year that an agricultural worker in the UK does. So that worker can grow a ton of beans and fly them to the UK and still use less carbon than somebody in the UK does. This is complicated stuff. This is not simple answers. And you take... I'm an organic producer, but you take organics. I know people in Burgundy who do their working of the soil only with horses, and they're spraying only with helicopters, so they don't put tractors on the land. Now, you know, this is the bizarre world that we live in, and this isn't easy stuff. Everybody has their own definition of what makes things sustainable. And that's why I was saying in the first place, we've got to look at bigger visions and we've got to think about these things more carefully. There are no glib answers.
And I think just in the newspaper yesterday, I saw discussion about the EU policy on biofuels. And I think it's an absolute classic example of the path, potentially, if you get on a hobby horse and you just drive that very hard without thinking about what the real consequences are of what you're doing, well, you go down the wrong path.
You mean that's where the biofuel one was, where you're clearing rainforest to make biofuel?
I mean, we've been trying to get biofuel for our tractors in New Zealand, but we'll only get it if we can get it from recycled cooking oil. We're not interested in getting it from any other source. And, you know, these things, there's no easy answers. And that's why it's pretty hard to get a tight definition on what does sustainability mean. You know, these are big, deep questions.
I just find it interesting that you can label something sustainable without a definition of what that means. And I also thought it was quite interesting that you don't want to use sustainability as a marketing tool, because I thought that was sort of the angle that it was going down.
Can I make a suggestion here? I don't think anybody is suggesting a label that goes in a bottle of wine that says sustainable. What you're saying is that you're part of a scheme that is looking at this ever-changing question and trying to do the best you can to do something to address it.
I like to use the term responsible viticulture, responsible winemaking, responsible business management or whatever, rather than things like sustainable. Because, you know, at the end of the day, as Tim quite rightly said, we want to leave things in a better position or better state than we came to them in the first place. And it's about being responsible.
Well, if you put a label on something, then it's getting to this kind of 20% less carbon or something. And these things are nonsense. It's got to be a moving program that is continually aware of issues and saying, what can we do to try and do this better?
There is a definition of sustainability, and which came out of the UN Rio conference in 1990, and it talks about what John has just said about utilising resources today without compromising the ability to utilise resources in the future. And, you know, what everybody is trying to do is put those sorts of words into practical effect. And, you know, we're having some discussions with the Californians and the Australians, for example, about getting a common protocol around carbon footprints. Because there's no point in New Zealand going out and doing its own thing. We need to have some sort of international collaboration to make sure that we're all sort of working in the same direction.
We can't be smug. You know, take my position in South Island, where all my electricity is carbon neutral. So does that mean I can use as much as I like? It doesn't, because if I don't use it, if I use it, that stops it being exported, and the surplus on South Island gets sent up to North Island, where they do use coal. So my being profligate, even though I'm being profligate with zero carbon electricity, is costing somebody else carbon, so it's costing the world carbon. So, you know, this is where this whole thing gets deeply difficult, and so there's never easy answers.
I think I get a feel for where you're actually heading, though. It's more about... it's almost like a glide path, trying to just generally reduce everything all the time and just make it more sustainable.
Yeah, it's continuous improvement. You know where you're at now, and try and make things better through time. And you know, in some ways, that implies there's no sort of end point here. That's an ongoing process that's going to across a range of activities that's going to go on for ever and a day.
All right, then. Well, thank you very much, guys. We'll wrap it up there.
Great.
Thank you very much, Neil, Tim, Nigel and Philip.
Thank you.
Cheers very much.